Hey, everybody. Thanks for being back with us as we continue in the book of Job. We find ourselves in the sixth verse of chapter one today. And this is, I think, really the heart of Job, this passage and what follows it. This is where it gets difficult. And I think what we're going to read, Michael, is troubling for people. I mean, it's just one of those, this is not an easy book, but this is one of the parts of it that I think leave people somewhat confused. So let me jump in. I'll read about six verses. We'll come back and we'll try to work our way through it. One day the heavenly beings came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From going to and fro over the earth and from walking up and down on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him on the face of the earth, a blameless, upright man who fears God and turns from evil." Then Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not put a fence around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand now and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well, all that he has is in your power. Only do not stretch out your hand against him." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. So I think this is, if one were to try and read this literally, it creates all kinds of problems. And one of the first ones we encounter is with the word Satan. In Hebrew, the word Satan means an accuser or an adversary, and it is used throughout the Old Testament, not as a name, but as a description. So for instance, David, when he's fighting the Philistines refer to David as a Satan. And there are angels that God sends to carry out judgment. They are called Satans. There are kings, human figures that are called Satans. And because this went on and later became the name by which we personify evil, it's a natural jump to envision that personified person, that the devil in the temptation narrative of Jesus, for instance. But it is very unlikely that that's what the author means. One is the language I've just told you, and the other thing is that Satan in Job always has an article in front of it. So it's the Satan. It's not Satan as we 2,000 years later, well, 2,000 years plus later, read it. And does that matter? Yeah, kind of. I mean, the idea that this being is among the heavenly beings, they're called the sons of God. And rather than being evil, this being is adversarial. In other words, he challenges God. God says, you know, "Wow, have you seen Job? He's doing great." And at that point, the Satan sees an opportunity to try to work against him.
You know, Clint, I do think that having context isn't necessarily going to soften the blow of this, but I do think it significantly helps nuance it. And there's a few things worth pointing out here, I think. And so the first one I want to point out is what we mentioned yesterday when we started this book, chapter 1:1. There once was a man, and we talked about how there's this sense that of a timelessness in the introduction of this book. Notice in verse 6, one day. So there's a literary thing happening there. You've got, you know, there once was a time, which is this sort of like what we have in the setup of some of our stories, you know, long, long time ago kind of setup. And then now verse 6, and then on one day, now we have the beginning of the action, that we are getting the context for the start of the story that's going to be told. And make note here that in ancient culture, this idea of there being, as we have translated here, these heavenly beings, it would be very common in that culture for a king to have a court, and it was very common practice inside that court for there to be advisors and discussion, even debate and argument. There's very much this conception that the leader would be having these very strong conversations with people who would have wisdom, people who would have very specific roles and jobs that they'd be going out and either enacting or to be bringing back information, that this would all come to and from the king. And then that would go out from that court for the leadership guidance of the people. In a culture where that is a commonly known structure, it's hard, Clint, for us to not see a similar frame over the story that we have here. On one day, we have God, who's the chief of all the kings, and here comes the accuser. Surely in every court, you're going to have the people who are bringing information, which is both positive, and also you could have those who are bringing up information that's a challenge, right? And here you have this question then that gets set off. And interestingly, Clint, maybe the challenge begins with the way that this discourse starts. And that's when God says to the accuser, "Have you considered my servant Job?" There's a way in which maybe this story would be softer for us if that accuser is the one that brought the name, and you thought like he's the one who started the ante. But I think there's a sense in which, as you survey this whole thing, we just came off the heels of talking about how Job worked really hard to be righteous, and God knows it. God knows Job by name. God doesn't need to be told that Job's out there. Job's top of mind. And yet the reverse side of that, Clint, is that in a way, God's the one that incites this action.
Yeah, and the Satan is the adversary, the one who works against. That's why Satan becomes the name Satan, being the supreme example of working against God. And God gives Job such high praise. There's no one like him on earth. But the Satan, working now against that, says, "Does Job fear you for nothing?" Of course he's righteous. You reward him. Of course he does good, because he knows how much he gets out of it. He hasn't suffered, so he has an incentive to do well. And here we begin, we'll have lots of opportunities to talk about this, but here we begin to see the framework of this book. When you do right, you get blessed. When you do wrong, you get cursed. And it is that framework that everyone in the story, including Job himself, is going to share. That is the outlook that defines the story, particularly the discourse of this book. And the accusation that the Satan makes is, well, of course he's upright. You made it easy for him. You bless him every time he does good, so he turns around and does more good. Again, working against righteousness, working against God. And God in this hears the challenge and says, okay, then you can do what you want to him. In other words, the Satan has thrown down the gauntlet. I bet he would curse you. And God says, okay. Notice that it's not a bet in the classical sense, because the Lord just gives him permission. This could just as much be read God proving his case than it is. I don't know that you should read this to think that God is also trying to see what Job will do. That's a little limited of the general portrait of God in the Old Testament, but there certainly are people who read it that way. I think maybe that's a secondary issue. The the main point I think we'd want to come out of this with is God praises Job, Satan questions that praise, and God allows the Satan to work against Job to either see what will happen or to prove his point.
I think it's interesting that this follows right on the tail of verse 5 here, where Job explicitly mentions this concern, my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. There's a sense in which that theme of it's not just the action undertaken, but it's the heart behind it that we now see coming front and center here. Because here, it's, well, the reason why Job's a righteous man, the reason why Job is upright and works so hard is because you've made life, you've given to him good. And so therefore, his heart is the thing that's called into question. I mean, ultimately, the thing that is being asked of here is Job righteous because that is integrated into his character, or is it a byproduct of his circumstance? And so I think you're right to point out, Clint, that there are a variety of ways that you could look at this story. If you're a person who did think of this as some kind of smoky room with people playing some kind of card game, and you think, and it seems to you like, well, I bet you this, I think you might be challenged to read this story and find, yeah, there is a spot in the story where you can see that God is so confident in his servant Job that this isn't really a debate from God's perspective. In other words, it's to say, I know Job's character. That's what I said in the beginning. And the accuser is going to find out that God is correct, that is seen. Of course, that's troubling because of the cost that's required in verifying the truth of Job's character. But yet, all of this, and you're right to say, I don't mean to just repeat here, but I think we have to understand that this is all done so under the rubric. It only makes sense if you understand that formula. You have to enter into the story recognizing that people who do good things should get good results, and the converse should also be true. What happens in this story is ask the question, what happens when that becomes inverted? And where is not necessarily God in it, because there's going to be a way that God gets the final word, and I'm not certain that God wraps that up in a way that we would find satisfying. I certainly think what it has to do is reflect upon the human experience of it, the questions, the anger, the fear, and maybe even more tellingly in some of the discourses, the justifications of it.
I think if you boil it down, the accusation that the Satan makes is that Job's faith is conditional, and that when it's no longer of benefit to him to praise God, he won't. That if he loses the blessing of his faith, he will lose his faith. He will curse God to his faith. And essentially the charge is that Job only praises God when it's in Job's best interest, or when it reflects Job's own blessedness, which is, a significant charge. That's when you lay that charge against the person that God says is the most righteous on the earth, the gauntlet certainly has been thrown down at that point. Michael, we won't be able to do this justice, but I do think it's important on this front end of Job here, because it's going to be consistently with us. I think at some point this book is going to make you wrestle with the concept of fairness. Because for this argument to be off in heaven somewhere on some day is one thing. But where the book goes next is to see the actual cost for Job, the suffering that's going to come to him. And is it fair that Job undergoes these things because the adversary has questioned his faith? And once his faith is questioned, the only way to then verify it is to let the adversary do these horrible things to Job. And God at very least allows that, perhaps even participates in it. God sets the limits and lets the adversary work within them, but it happens at God's permission. And I think the discussion of Job and fairness is a very tricky one, because as we understand fairness, it's not going to work. Because we share this same framework, if you do good, good should happen to you. And if you do bad, bad can happen to you, but they shouldn't get mixed up and they shouldn't cross over and there shouldn't be exceptions. And that's just not a framework. In fact, that's the framework in many ways I think this book is challenging, even dismantling. And so it is a very natural question, and it is very natural to be troubled by the idea that this doesn't seem fair to Job. And at some level, you just have to, if you get stuck there, that's all you'll see.
I think that that's absolutely right. And I want to add maybe one other place we could get stuck, Clinton. You mentioned this, but it's worth repeating. I think we would be very wise to not read this story looking for a literal theology that we're hoping to encapsulate in a simple tract that we hand out to people, because the way that this story is constructed, I know we've spent a lot of time at this point talking about some of these linguistic things, but it serves a purpose. And I think what we've got to understand is we're going to see the suffering that happens to Job is not abstract. It's not some pie in the sky kind of thinking. As the story gets told, it's successive waves of real loss in his life. And anyone who's lost in real substantial ways, that's going to be felt in your heart. As you enter into this, I think you've got to be really careful that you don't begin making one-to-one arguments that this portrayal of God is the single portrayal of God in Scripture, or is that somehow gives you a behind-the-picture scene of how things happen in the heavenly court? Is there something that we learn about the struggle of faith and the struggle of who we put our faith in moments of our suffering? Absolutely, Clint. But I think we've got to be really, really careful that we understand that this is put within the context of the whole Scripture, that this book is intentionally put beside other books, and that also, I don't think that what we have here is an exact outplay of when we suffer, exactly what happened in the heavenly court before it came down to. I think this story is here to crack open human suffering and to ask us the question, what is the nature of our heart and character in the midst of suffering? Where do we struggle to live our lives when it's not fair? And what has come to us we don't deserve? In the midst of that moment, what happens? And the Bible does that, but sometimes we oversimplify it and we make this thing a thing we want to map onto all the other things. And I think we gotta be careful to not do that.
There's a universality in the story of Job in that we all know something of suffering. We all have experienced, or perhaps we have witnessed someone suffer who we would say didn't deserve it, didn't bring it upon themselves, was a good person experiencing terrible things. And that's an invitation to the book of Job to explore those deeper issues. What I think we have to be careful with, Michael, as you're saying, is that that doesn't mean that Job is teaching us something universal. It doesn't mean that all suffering is a test. It doesn't mean that all suffering is God approved or that Satan has caused all suffering. This is a very narrow slice of a particular question for a particular time and place pointed at a particular person. It is not explaining the breadth of human suffering and all the possible reasons for it. In this book, we get what we don't get in life, a behind the scenes look.
Yeah.
And in this case, that specific behind the scenes look is that this is a tremendous amount of difficulty pointed at the most righteous man on earth, who is going to wrestle with his faith in the aftermath of that suffering, and is going to argue with three colleagues who present a religious answer to that that he finds unacceptable. And when we try, when the story of Job gets beyond the banks of that river, I don't think it is likely to help us. In fact, I think maybe just the opposite.
I think that's really well said and a great place to leave it today. We continue on tomorrow and we wade deeper in that river, and I think the current gets faster. So hope you'll join us for that. Like this video. If it has taught you something, encouraged you, inspired you to go along with us on the journey, subscribe so you don't miss the next episode. We'll see you tomorrow.
Bye. Hey, we want to thank you for listening to this broadcast. We're grateful for the support and the connections, the relationships we get to make through some of these offerings. We hope that they've been helpful. We know that there are lots of choices that you have, lots of things you can listen to. We want to make you aware of some of what we're doing, and we greatly appreciate you being a part of it.
Absolutely. We want to just thank you for being one of our audio podcast listeners. It's amazing to have you with us in the midst of our conversations. Of course, I hope you know that you can find the whole archive of all of these conversations at pastortalk.co. We would love for you to join us there. You can find options for subscribing by email. You can easily share things there with other people who you think might appreciate recordings like this. And of course, we just want to welcome you. If you're ever interested in joining us for the video podcast, you can do that on YouTube. It is youtube.com/FPC Spirit Lake. There you can comment and engage with us. Or if you would prefer to do that without going to YouTube, you can actually just click the link in the description of this podcast, where you will be able to send us a form and information and reach out to us. We'd love to hear from you and engage in conversation with you. Thanks again for taking time to be with us. We look forward to our next conversation and can't wait to see you then.